In the early days of the environmental movement, the children's author Theodore Geisel, better known as Dr. Seuss, wrote a book about saving trees. That 1971 book has now been made into a film, opening today, Dr. Seuss's The Lorax. Kenneth Turan has our review.
Movies have always monkeyed around with their source material, but Dr. Seuss's The Lorax actually apologizes for what it's about to do. The fuzzy orange Lorax, amiably voiced by Danny DeVito, steps out in front of a theater curtain and announces, "There's more to this story than what's on the page." You have been warned. Let's start with 12-year-old Ted, voiced by Zac Efron.
So, Mom, do you happen to know if there's, like, any place where I could get a real tree?
He's a miniature adult who uses breath freshener spray and has the wiseacre attitude of a Las Vegas lounge lizard. This irritating young man is infatuated with a girl named Audrey.
Hey, she is not some girl. She's a woman in high school, and she loves trees.
Fortunately, real trees have disappeared from the town. The only person who seems to have a clue about them is Ted's grandmother, voiced by Betty White.
Okay, here's the deal. The Onceler is the man who knows what happened to the trees. You want one? You need to find him.
Once the Onceler is tracked down to a desolate area, he is rightly suspicious of Ted's motives.
Why aren't you like other kids, breakdancing and playing the Donkey Kongs?
The Onceler eventually describes how his own youthful greed put him into conflict with the Lorax, who, as every reader of the Dr. Seuss original knows, speaks loud and clear for the trees. But to expand Seuss's slim volume to theatrical feature length, a whole lot of plot and heaping handfuls of characters needed to be invented. These new individuals are for the most part unpleasant, and the new aspects of a story are forced. By the time a cheerful song tries to rescue the film at the end, the original Lorax has left the building and is not coming back.
Kenneth Duran reviews movies for Morning Edition and the LA Times. It's Morning Edition from NPR News.
From NPR News, it's All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Audie Cornish. Devin McEwen is hoping to qualify for the Olympics. His event is a sport he's been doing since he was 5 years old, whitewater slalom. As we hear from Craig Lamolt of member station WSHU, he's following in his father's footsteps.
So this is a C2, or two-person canoe.
Devin McEwen picks up a red boat that's about 14 feet long. It looks more like a kayak than a canoe, but you kneel in it instead of sitting and use a canoe paddle. This is a whitewater slalom boat. Big comic book letters across the top spell out the word whoosh, with the two O's being the holes where you get in. That design is by Devin's mom, who happens to be the famous illustrator and children's book author Sandra Boynton. Devin says he loves competing in the whitewater slalom because the constantly shifting rapids create what he calls a living landscape.
Whitewater, it's just, you feel like you're interacting with another being almost, the way that it fluctuates and it's unpredictable.
He's still got some big challenges ahead of him before he can pack for the London Games. First, the U.S. team will have to win at the Pan American Championship in Brazil later this month in order to even qualify to send a boat to the Olympics. Then, he and his partner, Casey Eichfeld, will have to compete in trials to win the right to paddle the U.S. boat. If he does make the team, he won't be the first McEwen Olympian. His father, Jamie McEwen, competed twice in the sport.
I don't know. I can't really compare myself to my dad in terms of the Olympics.
Growing up, Jamie's family ran a summer camp, and canoeing was just one of the things he did for fun.
All of a sudden, they announced out of the blue it was going to be in the Olympics. And it was like, wow, you know, are you kidding? This backwoods thing we do, you know, so casual.
He wound up qualifying for the 1972 Munich Olympics, where he won a bronze medal. But then, just as quickly as it became an Olympic sport, it disappeared. It wasn't until 20 years later that the sport came back and he got another shot at the Olympics. At 39 years old, Jamie and his partner placed fourth in Barcelona. And now, another 20 years later, his son Devin is hoping to compete in the 2012 Whitewater Slalom event. Just outside Devin's front door and across a small street is the Housatonic River. They've set up a slalom course on a spot where there are some mild rapids.
There are cables strung over the river, and hanging from them are PVC pipes.
As he stands on the porch looking out over the Housatonic, it starts snowing.
It really is one of the coolest experiences in the world to be out on the slalom course when it's snowing. It makes you feel like a tough guy.
So can we go be tough guys then?
Absolutely.
Devin carries the canoe to the river's edge and gets in the back. Then it's my turn.
So what you want to do is just step into the center.
An elastic skirt fits snugly around my waist and connects to the canoe to keep the water out. And then... that's all the sound I managed to record at the river. That's because about a minute after we pushed off onto the Housatonic, the canoe flipped. Devin leaned upstream and the river caught the edge of the boat. And suddenly I was upside down in ice-cold water without a paddle. Here's Devin after we dried off and warmed up a bit.
So we had a little bit of a swim. The only real damage was to my ego.
Devin's trying to see it as a good sign. He says hopefully he's gotten that out of his system. And now he can go on to Olympic victory. For NPR News, I'm Craig Lamolt.
The Supreme Court has also decided to revisit the issue of affirmative action next fall. And that has college and university presidents wringing their hands. The use of racial preferences has played a central part in school admissions. But critics of affirmative action argue it's unfair and not the only or even the best way to diversify the classroom. NPR's Claudio Sanchez has that story.
Let's assume that when the U.S. Supreme Court decides Fisher versus the University of Texas at Austin, colleges will have to once and for all remove race and ethnicity from consideration in their admissions policies.
It is very alarming.
Marvin Krislov is president of Oberlin College in Ohio.
We are very worried that an adverse decision could impair the ability to enroll a diverse student body, and I suspect that that would be felt at other selective colleges and universities.
The defenders of race-based affirmative action are very principled, but I think they've exaggerated the claims about what will happen.
That's Richard Collenberg, author of The Remedy, Class, Race, and Affirmative Action. He says a ban on affirmative action will force colleges to do what they should have done a long time ago, replace race with class.
Right now, universities don't do that. They don't consider socioeconomic status in admissions, even though they say they do. At the selective colleges, you are 25 times as likely to run into a rich kid as a poor kid.
That's not because colleges don't recruit and enroll poor kids, says Krislov. They do.
But it is not a substitute for considering race and ethnicity insofar as it affects an individual applicant and the qualities that he or she brings to a student body.
Collenberg disagrees. He says there are race-neutral policies that are working just fine in states like Florida, Washington, California, and Texas. Yes, that's right, Texas, says Collenberg. The University of Texas at Austin, the very institution that's now having to defend its use of race in its undergraduate admissions, also has a very successful race-neutral policy.
They admit students who are in the top 10% of every high school, and they also provide a leg up to socioeconomically disadvantaged students.
Of course, that happened only after the university was ordered in 1996 to remove race from its admissions decisions. And to everyone's surprise, says Collenberg,
through these race-neutral means, they were able to produce a class that was more racially diverse than in the days when Texas used race.
For 9 years, the university relied exclusively on race-neutral policies. Then it put race back into the mix. In 2005, it decided that one out of every five students who applied would be admitted based on things like teacher recommendations, talent, test scores, grades, and race. That's why Abigail Fisher, a white applicant, sued the university in 2008. She was not in the top 10% of her high school graduating class, but the real reason she was rejected, she argued, was because she's white. This is the case the Supreme Court will take up in October. What's frustrating about all this for colleges is that they thought the constitutionality of affirmative action in college admissions had been settled. In 2003, the court upheld the University of Michigan Law School's use of race. End of story, says Oberlin's Marvin Krislov.
So colleges and universities have been relying on that guidance from the Supreme Court. It's been affirmed by the Department of Education on multiple occasions.
But come October, there's a good chance institutions will once again have to rethink entirely what role, if any, race will play in their admissions policies. Claudio Sanchez, NPR News.
Researchers at Dartmouth College recently found high levels of arsenic in rice, NPR's Nancy Shute is covering this story. She's in our studios. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Steve.
And, of course, she also follows this story on our food blog called The Salt. So why would there be arsenic, a poison, it's what we know it as anyway, in rice?
You know, Steve, this is a surprise to a lot of us. It turns out that arsenic is naturally occurring in soil and water, and rice plants seem to have this special ability to soak up more arsenic from the environment than other plants. So it's just there naturally.
This has been happening for thousands of years, though. I mean, people have been eating rice for a long time.
That's right. We're not talking about enough arsenic to poison you. We're talking about low-level exposure that over time might increase your risk of cancer, heart disease, maybe diabetes. So that's what the health folks are concerned about here.
Any particular difference between brown and white rice?
You know, some studies have found that brown rice might have a bit more, probably because it hasn't been polished. And, you know, some studies have said maybe basmati has a little less. But the problem is we really still don't have enough information to be able to say, okay, this rice has less, this rice has more.
Well, maybe that's the answer to the next question. Any particular difference between organic and non-organic rice?
No, there's no difference in the amount of arsenic in organic versus non-organic.
What got scientists thinking about this to begin with?
There has been problems in Bangladesh where there's high levels of arsenic in water, and they've been able to document more health problems there. And recently, that's got the scientists looking in other places, too. They're also concerned because in the United States, in the past, we used arsenic in pesticides on cotton. Some of those areas are now growing rice, and that might boost the amount of arsenic in our rice here, but we really don't know.
Okay, so we're talking about naturally occurring arsenic that gets concentrated by the plant. There may be circumstances where there's also been pollution that puts more arsenic in the soil and gets even more concentrated by the plant. That's what we're talking about.
That's exactly right.
Does it also get concentrated even more because we're talking in many cases about processed foods like rice bars for children, that sort of thing?
Exactly. That's what the Dartmouth researchers found out. They looked at products that would have maybe three or four different rice products in it, the brown rice syrup, rice flour, and those foods seem to have more arsenic in them. It wasn't concentrated so much as there's just more stuff there. The scientists are also concerned about foods for babies. Very often we feed babies rice cereal and things like that. And children are growing quickly. Their bodies are small. The British said 2 years ago, don't feed kids rice milk because they might be getting more arsenic than you'd like.
The United States has not said the same thing?
We have standards for arsenic in drinking water, but we don't have standards for arsenic in food.
Should I be terrified?
The scientists say not terrified, but cautious. And they said two things. One thing we can do is steer away from some of these foods that might have four or five different rice ingredients. Another thing is that, sure, go ahead and eat rice, but when you do, you know, mix it up. Maybe have rice, but then have some other foods too. Just vary your diet.
So the bottom line is there's always been arsenic in rice, tiny, tiny, tiny amounts of it. And the key is moderation. Just don't get too much of it at any one time.
That's right. The FDA is sampling rice around the United States now and doing a study. We expect to have the results of that sometime this spring. And we'll be covering that in NPR's food blog, The Salt.
Nancy, thanks very much.
Thank you, Steve.
That's NPR's Nancy Shute.